Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Started off as being very attracted to other girls. And I didn't really start to be attracted to boys until probably my mid-teens.
Sean? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science! Exactly.
We know it's a good idea because it's lasted.
We can teach kids and they get it.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
It's in whiskey. It's in ice cream. It's in who you fall in love with.
That's the recipe for success.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye, and this is the show where science rules, and it's a call-in show. So if you want to be on the show, and I hope you do, the number to call is 470-ASK-BILL. That's 470-275-2455, 470-275-2455. To find out when to call, check me out on the old electric internet. And once again, I am joined, of course, by science writer, editor, and dear friend, Corey S. Powell. Greetings, Corey.
Greetings, Bill. Good to be here. Now, wait a second. I recognize that voice. Not your voice. I definitely recognize your voice. But that voice that we were hearing earlier, that's comedian Margaret Cho. She's so good.
Oh, yes. And we started today's show with that clip because today we are talking about sexuality. A subject of great interest to, well, really, to everyone.
Yeah, pretty much everybody.
Yeah, pretty much. Joining us today to talk about the science of sexuality, because this is the Science Rules podcast, Corey.
Science.
Yes, we're joined today by Associate Professor of Psychology and Co-Director of the Gender and Sexuality Studies of the New School for Social Research right here in New York City, Dr. Lisa Rubin. Welcome, Dr. Rubin.
It's great to be here.
Everybody talks about sex, but you've taken it up a few notches. How did you find your way into this field of human sexuality?
Well, I really found my way into the field of gender studies. Well, you can't really do gender studies without also talking about sex and sexuality. You know, my background, I'm actually a clinical psychologist. And I was interested in feminist identity, what identifying as a feminist means. I study sexual identity in relation to health. The field that I teach has changed, and my teaching has changed dramatically.
Over how long?
I mean, I would say over the last, I've been teaching for 15 years, but I've tried to stay relevant. Hopefully I have. And that's partly because I'm catching up to the students as much as I'm learning with them as much as I'm teaching them, right? Especially in this field of
sex and
sexuality.
So what has changed?
Our understanding of gender has changed fundamentally. I mean, I think when I first began teaching, I sort of gave the, you know, I would begin my class with how we talk about sex and how we talk about gender. And sex is something biological and gender is something psychological and social. And my understanding of sex has changed, right? That sex is not something, meaning, you know, sexual categories are not something that sort of inherently exist in nature, outside of language, outside of culture. I still emphasize that distinction between sex and gender, but in a bit looser of a presentation.
So, Doctor, on the Netflix show Bill Nye Saves the World, on which Corey was, of course, a writer later on.
It's a great show. It's still available for streaming, I do believe.
Yes, stream it. Turn it up loud. But the most controversial show, for sure. Now, at Netflix, the way they work, you don't know if it's the most popular or the ratings and this and that.
Well, if you look at the social media footprint or the public outrage and the public acclaim, certainly the show that stirred people up the most.
So we had we were doing research the way one does, and we came up with this gizmo to illustrate what were called the four attributes of sexuality. And I'd like to play a clip from that show. It's only a few seconds, hoping for your thoughtful response on the other side.
Right now, biologists, sociologists, anthropologists, they're all trying to figure this out. And they're finding human sexuality is on a spectrum. And if you're like me, and I know I am, you're still learning about this field of science. I used to think there were just two settings, male and female. But it's actually a lot sexier than that. Check out the smoking hot abacus of sex.
The crowd helped us out there, but it was a great big aluminum thing where we had sliding spheres, very similar to a regular abacus that you use for computations. And we had, based on what we believed was the latest research, there were four attributes. The first one is sex, then gender, then attraction, then expression. And I think you have the same four, or do you have another one?
Or maybe slightly different wordings, but the same concept.
So what is sex? Let's start there.
So sex can mean many things, but here I think I assume your abacus is referring to what is typically referred to as sort of, you know, the biological assignment of male or female or intersex.
What is intersexuality?
So intersex refers to a range of sort of, you know, human variation that could be chromosomal, right? Not everybody having an XX or an XY chromosome. They can have an XXY, you know, an XO, and as
you
well—
You can have more than two, mm-hmm. is a discovery.
Yes,
right?
Exactly, yeah. Right. The presentation of the genitals may look different. The way people respond to hormones may be different. So these are all the ways that intersex may manifest. And so people who are intersex may absolutely identify as male or female. Intersex is different than gender identity. Intersex is talking to, you know, is referring to, you know, range of biological variation that, you know, doesn't sort of match the sort of typical or normative people who are assigned to their sex.
All right. Gender. What is gender? And we used to think that sex and gender were the same thing, but in your world, we're separating those for clarity.
Exactly, right. So sex is referring to something biological. Gender is referring to something social and psychological. Both, you know, I think we're increasingly understanding exists beyond a binary.
I think we can all agree on attraction. That's to whom you are attracted.
Uh-huh. So attraction, to whom you're sexually attracted.
If you're attracted to both.
Right, exactly, right. Bisexual, you know, fits within a binary, you know, being attracted to men and women, but not everybody identifies with a binary themselves or in relation to their partner. So pansexual may be a better descriptor.
Now, is this have to do with arousal? Attraction is
so attraction and arousal are close cousins, right? Arousal being more physiological, attraction being both psychological and physiological.
And then expression is how you present yourself.
Expression, I think, is both behavior, right? Because just being attracted to somebody doesn't necessarily mean acting on that attraction. Just being aroused by somebody doesn't necessarily mean, you know, acting. So sexual behavior, sexual expression to me would be about sexual behavior. Expression could also be about gender expression, right? Which would be sort of how one expresses one's gender. So I think you're calling that
sort of part of identity.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, I think the four categories may sort of flatten a little bit, sex and gender.
What do you mean flatten? Merge?
Merge,
blend?
Yes. So that
the spheres on the abacus would move together.
Uh-huh. Right. I mean, sexual orientation as we understand it is often grounded in cisgenderism in that, you know, people...
Cisgenderism.
Yes, yes. So the sort of view, you know, a starting point of organizing the world in terms of an assumption that everybody is cisgender.
What's cisgender?
What's cisgender? So cisgender are people who identify with the sex and gender that they were assigned with at birth. So I was assigned female at birth, and I still identify as female.
I'm male. I identify as male.
Yes, okay, exactly.
Cool. Do you guys still people in your field still study Kinsey and Kinsey?
Yeah, you know, Kinsey...
What did they do? What is this? Can you summarize it?
Yeah, I mean, so Kinsey... was really the first to study, I shouldn't say the first, but I mean, but I think the most notable to study on a large scale, you know, sexuality, including studying sexual arousal. But I think what Kinsey is really most famous for is in some ways the Kinsey scale and for expanding our ways of thinking.
The Kinsey scale.
Right. So can you decode that for our listeners?
Right. So the Kinsey scale, you know, basically in terms of thinking about language, as we were talking about, I think offered up the notion of the spectrum, right? That sexuality may exist on a spectrum. And so in measuring sexuality, provided people with the option of responding on a spectrum. And when he did that, found that, turned out, when you provide that option, sexuality seem to exist more on a spectrum. Now, some of Kinsey's findings have not been fully replicated, but the Kinsey scales remain...
For example, what's one that hasn't been... Because that's just... Come on, more.
Yeah,
tell us
yeah.
more.
I mean, I think the 10% statistic that gets sort of, you know, bandied about being that across cultures and populations, 10% of the population identifies as gay. And again, we didn't have the sort of... Kinsey didn't have the whole LGBTQ framework, right, that we have now. So, you know, and I'm not a Kinsey expert to know, you know, but I think he would say 10% non-heterosexual, right?
Right.
And we know that the number is likely lower than that, right? More recent studies suggest somewhere closer to, you know, 3.5% to 4.5%. And at the same time, that changes when we're talking about different cohorts. Younger people report slightly higher levels. There are some differences across comparing men and women as well, and differences in terms of percentages who identify as heterosexual and gay or bisexual, with women being more likely to identify as bisexual.
But then how does what Kinsey was talking about, how does that compare to the kind of sexuality spectrum that you were talking about earlier, sort of the way you think about it today? How has that thinking evolved?
So Kinsey did not necessarily differentiate in quite the same way, right? Sexual, you know, attraction, sexual identity. And so that is in some ways some of the trouble with the measure in that one has to...
You're taking somebody's word for it.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. It's a self-report measure. Yeah. This is, you know, and so self-report measures can really be valuable because how people
perceive themselves
is very important. At the same time, how people report how they perceive themselves is connected to culture.
That can, yeah, I don't really smoke. I mean, I just have cigarettes all the time, but I don't that
right,
kind of,
exactly.
I'm I not don't a smoker, smoke everybody.
You know.
I don't smoke.
Now, Kinsey's research and this, you know, asked about sexual behavior, but the, you know, the Kinsey scale, right, is sort of a mostly heterosexual, mostly, you know, it's sort of a scale around. And so it puts a single spectrum with homosexuality on one end, heterosexuality on the other end, and allows people to identify across the spectrum. People who identify as bisexual and pansexual tend to identify the least with that way of measuring, right? Qualitative study sort of indicate that they feel most frustrated when presented with that scale.
They'd rather have more dimensions.
Mm-hmm,
so
yeah.
Like we took a shot with our abacus.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So the question, the thing that everybody wants to know, the deep, giant question is these spectra of sexual attributes, are they inherited? Or are they learned? Mm-hmm. Is it in nature or is it nurture?
And I think
so. What's the answer,
Dr.
Rubin?
I mean, the answer is we got to stop asking the nature versus nurture question, right? In that, you know, the evolutionary theory itself is not about nature versus nurture. It's about nature and nurture, right? So we know in terms of sexuality that there's a large genetic component, a large biological component. We know that genetics seems to explain about 30%. You know, there was a recent genome-wide association study that does not, there is no single gene. There's no one gay gene.
Is there a combination?
And it seems that there are multiple genes that taken together account for about 30%, about a third of the variation that we see.
So you do gene sequencing? You take blood samples or DNA samples or something?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, again, this is always, always about the challenge of measurement. So you still have to look at people who self-report at some level, whether they report behaviors or whether they report their identity, and a combination of looking at, genome-wide studies, right, genome blood draw studies.
Cheek swabs.
Uh-huh, cheek swabs, blood draws, exactly, but mostly cheek swabs, right, 23andMe type. But, it doesn't mean that the other 70% is therefore social or environmental exclusively. It just means that so far we've explained roughly a third through genetics, right?
Can sexuality then, can I add the fourth dimension? Mm-hmm. This is to say, can it change over time? Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Well, there's certainly people who say, I discovered I was bisexual. Mm-hmm. I discovered I was gay. I discovered I was trans. Mm-hmm. I mean, you certainly hear that. Is that something that can switch back and forth?
If somebody says that they were heterosexual and then they later say that they are bisexual, have they changed? Or, have they, just like maybe I used to, not like Malaysian food and now it's my favorite food, right? Have I, have I become a different kind of eater, or have I just found something different that all of a sudden, I realize that fits with me? And, so it's sort of, again, how do we think about identity? Do we think about, in terms of fluidity, people's sense of them, and again, are we talking about behavior, expression? Are we talking about identity? Are we talking about attraction? So people may tap into different aspects of themselves, and that may cause them to change how they think about themselves. We find that that there probably is more fluidity among women than men across time, as well as in terms of initial identification. Again, as I said, women are more likely to identify as bisexual. And I'll give a shout out.
What's pansexual?
Pansexual, I think, responds to thinking outside the binary. So if bisexual is clearly tied to a binary, so somebody who likes men and women. Now, that limits you. It leaves out, a growing number of people. Yeah, a recognizable number of people who don't necessarily identify along the binary.
All right.
I feel like we all understand that all kinds of aspects of human psychology are complex and overlapping and changeable. You're not, ambitious or lazy, just one or the other. The idea that sexuality has to be just one thing or the other thing, and that's it, and it doesn't change, intuitively, that doesn't make sense.
When you couch it that way, no.
Yes, thank you.
Stick around for more Science Rules after this.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley, in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Science Rules is back.
And here to help us grapple with sexuality is comedian, actress, author, and designer. Welcome to Science Rules, Margaret Cho!
Yay!
Thank you. Wow, that's great.
Thank you, Margaret. Margaret, you and I go back, my friend. Margaret, you
we
and
do.
I, yes, you may remember being on Saves the World.
Yes,
we
of course.
Were cooking. You were quite the chef, quite the culinary artist. And you also may remember being on the Science Guy show about populations.
Mm-hmm.
And you were eating grapes because you were a population competing for resources. It was
this is a
fabulous science point that you helped
make. You remember this formative experience of being a grape?
I'm sorry,
eating a grape?
I did. And I remember also we were in a display of yours, I believe, was it Disney World? And it was, I was a cloud with, I think, Paul Rodriguez.
Yes,
and,
you were.
And you were. It was your exhibit there. That was probably in the mid to early 90s. So it's been a long time.
Yes, from back in the 20th century.
Yes, yes.
Now, I'm so happy you're willing to take the time to talk about this.
Of course.
When was the first time you heard about these four scales or four attributes of sexuality on the sexual spectrum?
I don't know. I mean, I think it was maybe more explained to me in the Kinsey scale. My family ran a bookstore that was a gay bookstore in San Francisco in the 70s. So I was maybe about 7 or 8 years old, and we were employing a lot of gay men. And my mother was trying to explain to me that gay people were just like straight people. And it was hard to grasp even at that age to really understand that, but that they were attracted to the same sex and had relationships with the same sex. And they employed a lot of gay people, lesbians and gay men. And but I didn't really learn much about transgender people until probably about 10 years later in San Francisco. There were different people. I was still working at the bookstore and also working in different areas and starting comedy. And there were different people that I knew who were transitioning to become women or men.
What happened when that sort of that kind of acceptance that you were seeing in your own family, when you got out to the larger world and ran into places where it wasn't quite so accepting?
Well, you know, we had, unfortunately, some incidents of violence, gay bashing around our neighborhood, which is a gay neighborhood at the time. And this is in the 70s and the 80s. And so these incidents were growing more common. And then there was, of course, the terrible advent of AIDS, which you could see the problem that society had with the disease and the coverage of it and the way that people talked about being gay during that time, you know. And it was a very it was something that my parents had warned me about, saying that a lot of people were very, very homophobic, and you were going to see much of this as we grow up and we look at the world and see what happens. So, you know, they set me up for it. And I think that they also knew that I was gay myself. I'm actually bisexual. So I think they were sort of trying to help me out by saying that they understood.
How do you discover you're bisexual?
I think that for me, it started off as being very attracted to other girls because I formed friendships that were very intense with other girls when I was a younger person and a kid, basically, that would result in crying fits. And I have to be with her. I have to be with her. And, you know, it wasn't even like it was a relationship exactly, but it was just a lot like intense attachment. And I didn't really start to be attracted to boys until probably my mid-teens. So my initial introduction to those kinds of very overwhelming crush-type feelings were towards girls in the beginning. I think that people thought that I was gay, you know, that I definitely had that kind of thought about me, that people really just made that assumption. I think that that helped to kind of form the way that I kind of felt about myself, you know, that I felt more comfortable in that position. But then also later when I became attracted to boys, it was very confusing. And then I was like, I didn't even know where to begin of where to start. Cause you know, when you have an idea about yourself and then it changes, it's very confusing.
Right. So by the time you were performing on stage, I mean, did you feel like you could be accepted?
Yes. That was the one area that I felt really comfortable. I think also because a lot of the women in comedy that I knew were lesbians, you know, and I opened for Ellen at the time, you know, and this is long before she was, known by the, you know, everyone and before her television show. And I also worked with Rosie O'Donnell. And so I felt comfortable because the image of women in comedy, and my favorite comedian at that time was Paula Poundstone. She was so smart, and she didn't even have to talk about sexuality, that there was something that was distinctly asexual about her. And I really identified with that.
As you may know, Margaret, this is a call-in show.
Yes.
And we are excited to have in-callers, people calling in. And I believe we have out there Nathan. Nathan, are you on the line, and where are you calling from?
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me on the show. I grew up watching Bill Nye the Science Guy, and stoked to be able to talk to the Science Guy. I never thought I'd be able to do that. So thank you, man.
I love you, man.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
I'm calling from Bradenton, Florida.
There you go. All right. And you have a question.
Yes. My question is, what does acceptance of the LGBT lifestyles do for mankind as a species from an evolutionary standpoint? Where might natural selection come into play here? And what, you know, where does the versatile, a more versatile family take us as a species in 100 years from now?
Well, the whole thing in evolution is your offspring. So if you, if you don't have any kids, then whatever choice you make socially is will get left in the past. There isn't a single gay gene, but one cannot help but observe all the cultural influences on people of all sexual orientations. And it also may be a so-called combination of genes that are, it's actually quite complex and not just a binary on-off sort of thing. Do you have any ideas? Have you observed anything about that, Margaret?
We're not absolutes. So you can maybe, if you have a tendency, like for me, it's a little bit difficult because it is like whether I'm attracted to men or women, I'm attracted to both. And so it's more maybe the conditioning that I had growing up that helped me feel freer about my decisions, about that I don't have to make a real decision. That may have helped me, that there was a kind of acceptance around homosexuality and the idea that I could be more fluid in my expression and who I was. So I think your family or origin, how they feel about what this is all going on, like that might kind of inform your decisions. But I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I don't believe that there is a gay gene, although there are quite a lot of gay people, so I don't know.
Yeah. So the other thing, Nathan, I just say, doing an accounting, the more energy we put into oppressing people, or the modern thing everybody's into is bullying people, or denigrating people, the less energy we have to do something productive. So I would say in 100 years, if we are more accepting of people of all orientations, I think everybody comes out ahead. Why waste energy? Just live your life.
I live in, I mean, it's a fairly progressive part of Brooklyn, but I also see a sort of a larger change going on kind of across American culture. I have two daughters, one in elementary school, one in middle school. And, you know, they are growing up in an environment where it's not just, you know, relatively non-judgmental about homosexuality, but also about kind of very accepting about the fluidity of gender, of gender identity. The main thing I see is that kids who probably would have been stressed out or repressed or somehow in other ways tamping down something about themselves feel that they can express it, follow where it goes, and it's not that big a deal. And I do think that on a large scale, that's going to be helpful. I don't know. And Margaret, do you see – are you seeing what I'm seeing? Do you feel like there is a change in the culture here?
Yes. And I also noticed a lot of younger people coming out as non-binary, which I think is really interesting because it's like that now we're not so beholden to these really stringent attitudes about gender and expression of gender. And so I think that's really freeing and really exciting.
So do you have any, Nathan, are you a product of a non-standard, non-traditional family?
I am not. I actually grew up in a very traditional family, and I'm very open and embracing of it. My daughter's godparents are actually a transgender couple. We actually just spent the weekend with them, went to a strawberry festival near Lakeland in Plant City here in Florida. So we're real good friends. My wife grew up with her friend and her partner, who is transgender, and they're wonderful people. And proud to know them and be affiliated with them. And, my biggest optimistic outlook with the change of lifestyles and the change of temperature in the culture is what it really does for broken homes, as far as, you know, my wife's family does foster care or did foster care at one point, adopted 5 kids. And when you start looking at a more stable and open home, that can adopt kids, you know, more available families, stronger families. I'm really optimistic on things that we could be seeing here down the future as more and more communities become open to the idea of a more versatile family model.
More, I think the word is progressive. As
yeah,
we progress, yes,
mm-hmm.
as society progresses. Yep. I think we are living at a unique time because of the speed of change. You know, I was in Australia for the first time a year and a half ago, and everybody was very excited that Australia had passed a gay marriage law. And people were excited about it because expressing an extraordinary opinion, you just wear yourself out fighting these things. Let's roll with it, for crying out loud. But anyway, hey, Nathan, thanks for for asking a question, and thank you so much for sharing your family story. Now, this brings us to a question from Autumn. I think Autumn has a heck of a thing to ask here. Autumn, are you out there?
Hello?
Yes, Autumn.
Autumn, hello.
You're on the line here with Science Rules. Where are you calling from?
Minnesota.
Fabulous. Where in Minnesota?
Down towards the Minneapolis area, but a little bit southern.
Okay. And you have a question?
Yes. I was wondering if sexuality can change over time or if it always stays the same.
Does your sexuality change over the course of your life? That is a heck of a question.
Big question.
Margaret, do you have any thoughts?
I believe it does. I mean, it certainly did for me, and it's continually changing. You know, not in really very big ways, but in ways that I understand. But yes, and I think also the way that hormonally, you know, that your life changes in so many ways. You know, I just turned 50, and I find that menopause is a gateway drug because it's very different now.
You started out attracted to girls.
Mm-hmm.
Then you were attracted to boys. Then you're attracted
yes.
to both.
Yes.
So over your lifetime, it has changed, rather. And this mm-hmm. would be on the scale of decades, right? Or
yes.
Yeah. So when you say menopause is a gateway drug, what gateway is it? Is it allowing you to pass through or
I think
over?
It's into a place of feeling like you're almost beyond sex, that it's beyond gender, and it's beyond this idea of procreation or anything like physical, that it becomes a very spiritual quest, you know, that your body lets go of a lot of the strong hormones that drove it to do certain things, you know, that drove it towards certain eventualities, whether that is having kids or having a family, that it's beyond that. So to me, being in this place of being a menopausal woman, I feel very different than I have in my entire life. In a way, somewhat asexual, somewhat genderless, and then also very strong within that gender. It's really interesting. I think now the attraction has gone beyond these ideas of who I was attracted to before, what I wanted before. Now there's like a definite before and after, and now it's definitely expanded. So I think it's like attracted to everything and everyone, and in a way that's actually not sexual, which is really weird.
Science Rules will be right back.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
You're listening to Science Rules.
But if you can hear this sound, oh yeah. Corey, that's the sound of superheated air.
Actually, I think...
Oh, there. Yeah.
There we go.
That's the sound of superheated air. Superheated, hotter than the surface of the sun for a few moments, creating thunder because, Margaret, it's time for the lightning round.
Ooh.
Are you excited?
Yes, very excited.
Are you sitting down?
Yes.
Stand up. Okay.
What's your favorite animal?
Dogs.
Why?
Because, well, I have one sitting in my lap this whole time, and she has not made one sound.
There you go.
Which is great.
What's not to love? Do you have a favorite tattoo?
I like all of them, but I think I like the ones on my back just because I can't see them. I'm not even sure what they are. I think there's a peacock back there.
Oh, there you go. Pink or blue?
I like purple.
There you go. Ooh. All right. Do you have a fashion icon?
I think it would probably be, who would be a good fashion icon? Maybe, David Bowie. He's a good one.
Oh, wow. There you go. How about a science icon?
I would say Bill Nye. Well,
there you go. Thank you.
Yes.
A comedy icon?
Probably always Joan Rivers.
Margaret, this has just been big fun. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been great having you here.
I'm Bill Nye.
I am Corey S. Powell.
And remember, when it comes to the sexual part of our universe,
science rules.
If you like Science Rules, and I hope you do, please take a moment to rate and review it in Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. It helps us out and helps other people learn about the show, leaving the world a better place. So thank you. Be sure to follow me on the electric internet for information about when to call into the show. I'm at Bill Nye on everything, on the electric Twitter machine and the gram and so on. Meanwhile, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, give us a call at 201-472-0785. That's 201-472-0785. Science Rules is produced by Jordan Bell and our own Corey S. Powell, with extra production from Lisa Wang and Ashley Warren, who screened your calls today. Our engineer today is Jared O'Connell. Mixing and original theme music by Casey Halford. Special thanks to Claire Rawlinson. Chris Bannon is the Chief Content Officer, the CCO of Stitcher. And at Stitcher, you know, science rules.
Stitcher.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.